With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate.
Welcome back and good morning to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. And joining me now, haven't caught up though for a while, first time in 2024, is my lifestyle guru, Annie Hart. We've done debt, we've done dating, Annie. It's now the trifecta for the D's. We're going to talk about death today.
I'm excited about that.
A lot of people are thinking, death, that's how can you be happy about talking about death? But we're going to talk about the practical elements of the process of death and dying. And both you and I have had experience in this, and it's something that people don't talk about, but if you're prepared, it actually can save a lot of heartache and actually be really fulfilling.
That's right. So this is a practical talk, and there's going to be some really detailed information about what happens to the physical body later on. I'll give you a warning, and that might be graphic for some listeners, but really just wanted to talk about how you can prepare for death, what to do when somebody dies, what your choices are, and how much it's going to cost. So I'm not really covering the spiritual side of death. I'm really covering the practical sides of death.
Yeah. And there are oftentimes, obviously, sudden death is something that will rock people and you're not prepared for it. And we can look at that element. But in the case of some general preparedness, let's sort of talk about some of the things that we can do when you do have an inkling that you need to get prepared, or even if you don't, like if we're all of us every day, some of the things that we can have in place that will make a tremendous difference if we were, you know, having to, you know, pop south of the border unexpectedly. And that is just in terms of basic preparedness. So what do you think is probably the first port of call for people?
The first port of call is to recognise that we're all going to die, no matter what. No matter what you believe happens afterwards, we're all going to die and leave this particular body that we're in currently. And I think getting a notebook or a file online, or however you want to do things, just starting to think about the choices for your own death that are going to happen. Now, for me, I experienced helping to find out from my mum what she and my dad wanted when they both died. And we talked through in quite graphic detail some of the things, like whether they wanted to be embalmed, whether they wanted to be cremated or buried, whether they wanted a service, where that would be, how big that would be, whether they wanted flowers, donations, or did they want a religious element because they'd met studying Bible in Bible class, did they want food afterwards, that sort of thing. And my mum and dad, being big into catering, wanted as many people to come as possible that wanted to be there. So we went through, and I sort of made my mother think about all the details that if we did them differently, she would be disappointed. So we went through everything. And of course, things like having a will, a memorandum of wishes, having people nominated to take care of your health and your finances if you're not compos mentis, meaning you're not mentally or physically able to, all of those ones in advance. You know, you might have a sudden or traumatic death. You might find out you've got a short time to live, and you might be too stressed at that, well, at the time that you find out you have a short time to live, to actually do the planning. I know a lot of people who know they're going to die have planned their deaths and what will happen after their deaths in fine detail, like you've experienced, and I've experienced that. So the sorts of things, making a will, really, really important. If you haven't made a will, for goodness sake, do that, because, and you can go to the Public Trust website and look up will, and that will tell you how to do it very cheaply. The will is really legally what happens to your stuff when you die, as you probably know. And even if you don't have a lot of stuff, it will be eventually sorted out and probably given to the next of kin if you don't do that yourself. But it will take a time, and the government will get involved. So the less involvement you want from government means make a will. Also, a memorandum of wishes to go along with that will, and preferably to be stored with that will, is a good idea. And it could be that you've made a will, and but you wish for certain things to happen in a certain way. Now, I'm trying to think of an example here. There's lots of them, like what happens to the dog or the cat. Might be something like when you die, you want to be viewed, if possible. You know, it could be that sort of stuff, or it could be about some of your smaller possessions. You know, you want the special mirror to go to your niece Jane, and you want this to go there, and you want a minor donation here or there, or you know, you want your house to be repainted before it's sold, or whatever it is. So memorandum of wishes is important. It's more about what's in your heart, about what you want to do.
It also stops those, if you've got siblings or family yes. members involved, yes. Death and weddings and funerals are the two times that can create a lot of fracture points within families. And if you've got a memorandum of wishes and a death book, yep. and you've laid all of that out in there, it really does save a lot of arguments for your mm-hmm. family. So mm-hmm. not only are you doing it for your own wishes, for what you want, you're also saving them the heartbreak of having to make that decision themselves or negotiate that decision with other yep. siblings.
Absolutely.
That makes a huge difference.
When my mum was planning her funeral and dad's funeral, we even got down to the songs, the types of songs she would like, the artists and the types of songs. And I would actually go onto YouTube and play the song, and she'd go, not that version. No, I don't like that version. That's too modern. I want the old-fashioned version. So we did quite a lot of that. The other thing was, I was just thinking when you said death book, and I'm thinking about an elderly person writing notes. Let's say you write a note in your book and you change your mind, cross it out and sign it and say cancelled. If, you know, like if there's a whole lot of stuff, this doesn't matter if it's a mess, as long as people control through and go, well, that's something positive. That's something she wanted. That's something she didn't want. And then that makes it really clear. The other thing people sometimes do is write letters or do a video recording to loved ones. And it might just be to a grandchild to say, I really love you. And as you grow up into a young woman, you might realize A, B, and C. And when you're at this certain age, I want you, when you're going to get engaged, to have my engagement ring. It could be something like that. Or it might just be saying goodbye. Some people that die from gnarly things like cancer or motor neuron disease do recordings when they're still looking as the person remembered them. Because sometimes when people pass, in the final days, they look pretty emaciated and drawn.
And technology has made it so easy to do that now.
Yeah.
Which is great. My the person close to me, she wrote her book was more, it was like part instruction manual, part yes. diary.
Yes.
And so once we got the instruction manual part nailed, she then took it away and we never saw it again until she passed. So it was funny because we sort of had, we knew the front part was the instructions. And so we took out all the instructions, and then her son and he said, oh, have you seen all the stuff at the back Mum's written it? And I said, oh, no. And yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It was, honestly, it was.
Treasure trove?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Quite the autobiography. Ooh. Quite the autobiography was written there, and things that we didn't know. And it was like, wow. But it was actually, what an amazing legacy to be left with. You know, all the things that she finally wanted to say, she was able to say. And it's, yeah, her son has
something liberating about knowing you're going to die. Something I was going to say, actually, as a wee aside to that, is I'm into genealogy. That's another topic. But there's a lack of detailed information about how people live their lives. So if you wanted to just do a little picture of even a part of your life, like your school days or your early childhood, or I met a woman yesterday in a queue that had a family, grew up in a family of 18 children. And just talking about how that dynamic worked, because it's interesting from generation to generation how quickly things change and people forget that people lived a different sort of life. So like when my mum and dad got married, for example, they had literally no furniture for a while. And I mean, that's kind of normal for flatting. And they used to use beer crates as tables. And you wouldn't, knowing them before they passed, you wouldn't think that they'd come from sort of an impoverished start, but they did. So it's you know, people often raise their eyebrows about what they find out. It's really fun and interesting.
I've got a good friend, and when her father passed, he was a very, very well-known principal in the region here. Six children in the family, and one of the grandchildren, he had a bit of a video set up, and he was a young adult, and he wanted to do exactly get record granddad's stories. And so when they knew, and he was in his 90s by this stage, they came to visit over sort of a period of about a year, they would carve out an hour or so to go and see granddad, take a camera, set it up, and record stories from when he had his first job teaching and when he met grandma and all of these just little vignettes and stories. Yep. And some of those were played at his funeral. And they were amazing. It was absolutely amazing. And it was all because one of the grandsons wanted, as he said, And that's the thing, the six children knew the stories because they'd partially lived the stories, but you don't necessarily share them. No. And I've had this with my own son, something cropped up recently, and I told the story, and he looked at me and he said, "You've never told me that."
Yeah, there you go.
I thought, oh, I probably haven't, because I know it.
Maybe we don't think we have a remarkable life, but all of our lives are actually remarkable in some way. And I think about me, I'm a serial learner, and recently I've just discovered I'm ADHD, and that explains the fact that I do deep dives into things. And so I've had a lot of experiences doing a lot of things that many people wouldn't know about. And one day I'm going to list them because it's a ridiculously long list, and maybe talk to some of those things for my own descendants. And even though I don't think I'm necessarily particularly important, it's the way we live our lives and the way that we think. Because looking back, we think that people in the past didn't think as complexly, in a complex way, as we do, but they did. They were just as intelligent. People think we're more intelligent as we go on, but actually it could be the reverse, not necessarily. So anyway, the other thing I just wanted to mention was the power of attorney, an enduring power of attorney. Now, you may not know this, but you can set it up with a lawyer fairly quickly. I had this with a family member recently when they were in intensive care, and we set it up. It took an hour. So there's two types of EPAs, enduring power of attorney. There's personal care and welfare, and then there's property. And you can have two different people as your enduring power of attorney. For example, if my husband wasn't about, I would want my sister to make my decisions about the decisions about my personal care and welfare. Now, this is if my brain is not capable of making that, or I'm deemed not capable of making those decisions. And then there's property EPA. Now, I hear of many situations where people evoke the power of attorney too early when the person actually is still capable of making the decision. So you need a very strong conversation about that, and you need to make sure that your lawyer is really on board and that other family members know. And I think it's a good idea to circulate it, because quite often someone gets unwell and people go, "Who's the power of attorney?" And somebody finds out that they are, and they weren't asked. So I think you need to ask and let them see the paperwork and have a copy of the paperwork, because finding paperwork's often an issue. So while we're about it, if you were to have a little drawer or a place with all your important paperwork with your will, you also want to find your birth certificate and put that in there, because when it's time to look for the death certificate, they need the birth certificate to refer to who your parents were and when you were born and where you lived and all that stuff. So the public trust has a lot of information about power of attorney. So there's free information everywhere about death, which is great. So legally, just let's get the legal stuff out of the road. When you die, who has the authority to make decisions about what happens with you? So if there's a will, the executor usually has authority. If there's no will or none is found, the next of kin has legal authority. Now, that could be problematic if you don't get on with your next of kin, because it might be your brother. And the hierarchy has been determined by the courts, and here it is. Okay, so the first person they would look for would be a surviving spouse or a civil union partner or de facto partner that's been living with you for 3 years or longer. So if you were to die and you'd been living with someone for 2 years, they wouldn't have that. So that's interesting, though.
That's a change.
Yes.
That is a change, because it used to be a spouse and then civil unions, obviously a new thing. But I think de facto partners, that's been the last thing that's been added. Yeah.
I think so. Then after that, if there's none of those, it's the children of the deceased. Then if they're not there, the parents of the deceased, then the brothers and sisters, then the grandparents, and then uncles and aunts. So that's the order it goes through. And that I found that on a government website. So you can find it if you go look. But I do have some links that will be available anyway.
Yeah, all of those will be, of course, with our lovely Liz at inbox@realitycheck.radio. Annie has a huge wealth of resources that she's going to supply with us for this talk.
I do. The next thing to consider is how much money do you have, or how much money is left in the estate? If you have no money, did you know that WINS can give you a grant of up to $2,445? Now, again, if you go to Work and Income and you look up funeral grant, it'll just pop up and there it is. And just talking about costs, the costs you must pay, and then the costs you might pay. The costs you must pay is a medical professional has to confirm the death. So you probably have to pay the doctor for that. And because it may be a home visit, if they're not in a hospice or a hospital, it's 80 to 300 bucks, depending on their fees. You must pay for a casket or a shroud, and the law has just changed. I've just spoken to a funeral director yesterday about this, and you cannot be buried in just a shroud, which can be a sheet. It must have a tray underneath, and the reason for that is bodily fluids. And you can have a wooden tray that's got little sides. There's actually a standard for it in the Act. And then you need to pay fees for burial or cremation. Now, the good news is there are services in New Zealand that come in around that WINS grant amount of 2,445, and I can give the website for that in a minute. I just did a quick Google, and there may be more than one company, and I do not want to just promote one company, but there is a company that just does a very, very simple deal where the body is not viewed, they have a simple wooden casket and they get cremated, and everything's covered within that fee. And depending on which region you live in, it's between $2,400 and $3,000 at the moment. And I think that these costs go up on a yearly basis from what I understand. But the WINS grant will go up as well. And there are qualifying things on their website about how much income you have. Also, if the person has an estate, any belongings worth money, normally you can be paid back from the estate once things are cleared through. So they are the costs you must pay. And then the costs you might pay, as you imagine, might be having a service, a headstone, a memorial, embalming or looking after the body, cooling care. Some people just have their loved ones put in the fridge, like we did with my parents. Fees paid to a funeral director, which again, you can sit down with a funeral director in advance of a death and discuss all of that. And fees for legal help to deal with a person's estate, which could amount to several thousands. So that's sort of the overview of the money side. You cannot get away with just burying somebody in your backyard. Now, if you want to bury someone on your own land, and it wouldn't be in an inner city thing, you need to go to the council to apply for a permit. And there are people that have burial sites on their own land. I'm not sure about marae, but marae often have their own burial sites, which are listed burial sites too. So if you're doing it through your local marae, I would suggest discussing that ad in advance of your death or your loved one's death, just to find out the ballpark of how that works. And then from the practical side of who's doing what, you could use a funeral director. You can do some of the things yourself or all of the things yourself. Now, it is unusual these days in New Zealand to do all of the things yourself, but from my point of view, I am a home birther, a home schooler, a home deather, and a home funeraller. So when my loved one dies, and we have someone in my family that will happen to shortly, then our plan is to be so prepared that we can do most of the stuff ourselves. And there are also people out there in the natural burial world that sort of act like a midwife. They're not funeral directors, but they can guide you for a fee of $500 or $600. So you find them probably on Facebook and by asking around, but they're normally people that assist for burials or cremations, and they'll know all about the natural burial places and stuff like that. So where I live, you can be buried in a natural burial site, and it actually doesn't cost much less than having a burial, but you have a shallow grave and you're not to be embalmed, and they plant a tree over the site that you're buried and they GPS it so you know where your loved one is. And that tree is normally planted about a year later. And you that body there is going to grow the tree, which is kind of cool. So the thing that I think people get tied up with doing things themselves is the paperwork. The paperwork can be a little bit daunting, but I'm going to break it down and then we'll get into the physical side. The paperwork, first of all, when somebody dies, you need a death certificate from a doctor. So if they're in a rest home or a hospice or a hospital, you can get it from the hospital. If you have somebody that passes at hospital but you want them at home, absolutely you can do that, but there may be some paperwork to get them out of the hospital. Okay, so that's the next thing. Then if you are having the person buried or cremated, there's paperwork to fill out for that. And usually it's your local council that has the paperwork. Now, I've just looked up several local councils yesterday, and my local council has it as an online form, which I don't really like. I don't like online forms for that sort of thing. I like to write on them. So I imagine I could go into my local council and ask for it in paperwork. But you have to apply for a cremation because it's very final and it has to be signed off again by a nurse or a medical practitioner. So just be aware that that's an extra little step you have to jump through, and a funeral director often handles that. When somebody dies, as soon as they are moved anywhere, there's paperwork attached to them, and a lot of paperwork. So if your person goes into a funeral director's home, they will have to check the paperwork time and time again. And that's why people have a toe tag, because they don't want to mix people up. They don't know these people. And, you know, when they're naked on the tray, when they're doing their work to make them look lovely for you, if you're going to have a viewing, they don't want to mix that person up. And then also when they go to get cremated, they want to cremate the right person and make sure you do get the ashes, which does happen. In New Zealand, for sure. I've had that. I've talked to some embalmers and crematorium as well. So that's the thing. And then obviously if you're going to be buried, you need a plot. Now, burial plots locally in my district, I've checked out two councils, cost $1,750 in one place, $2,500 in another. And then when you inter the person, which means when they dig the hole to bury your loved one, if that's what you're going to do, interment at the moment is $900-ish. Now, those plot charges sometimes vary if you've got a small child. Cremation costs around $900 per adult. If the person is large, it costs more. Children cost less, and many places charge nothing for the cremation of somebody that was stillborn. So, you know, the website that I got mine from was all from my local councils. So it's all on my, I've actually downloaded a pamphlet with all the costs. And the woman at the counter, when I went into the council yesterday, assured me that the prices go up every year. Okay, for all of those things. So if you know you want to be buried and you've got the money, buy the plot.
Yeah.
And find out whether it's a single, a double, or a triple. Like, we want a triple, but we can only get a double. So one of my local burial grounds here is prone to flooding, and they can only do singles for that reason. So you need to ask that question. Your council will know. They may have a dedicated person that does all of that stuff. And yesterday when I was looking at a certain cemetery for us, they printed out to show me which plots were currently available. So you could walk around, choose your plot, pay for it. But remember, when you are going to be buried, the interment fee might be up over a grand.
Mm.
And when they reopen that plot to put the second person or the third person in, there's a fee each time. But at least you've got the plot.
And also, too, depending on the council and the cemetery, they do also have cremation gardens.
Yes, they do.
So, yeah, so that means...
And they cost.
But they cost as well. So they're a lesser cost. So it means that you can, essentially, you're buying a smaller plot in order to bury ashes. So that is another option for people, too.
Yes, and you can bury ashes and have a plaque put on top or a headstone. You need to ask your local council because some people have different rules and they won't want to have a headstone for ashes only plaques. Some are very specific and some are very general. Oh, the other thing too is if you are going to put a headstone, a place a headstone, that's usually later. Often people do it around the year mark or 6 months mark when they've had time to think about it, and you have to apply to do that. Now, I don't think there's a cost to do that because you're paying for it to be done, but you have to apply and you have to show them the size, shape, and the writing and what it's made out of. So, everything's filling out forms basically. So that's sort of the money side. And then, of course, you have to then register the death. Now, that's the birth, deaths, and marriage website. And that, I think you've got several weeks to do that. It might be 3 weeks. But again, if you look up BDM or births, deaths, marriage, it's all there. And I think I like people to do their own research because things change. Okay, things do change. There is a really, really good website that I found that's a government website that has a lot of stuff about death. And it talks about the first few hours, the first few days, the first few weeks. And it guides people through many of the stuff with many links. So I don't want to reproduce that. But it's called, and again, it'll be in the show notes. It's called, I can't remember what it's called, but anyway, our end of life services. Oh, it sounds awful. Endoflife.services.gov.nz. Find out. So it's actually quite good. I found that there was more information there. I was surprised at how good it was, honestly.
One of the things, because I have an aunt who's a funeral celebrant.
Ooh.
And has been, in fact, the person that was very close to me who passed away 20 years ago this year was her first funeral.
Yeah.
So she was shoulder tapped by another family member and said, I want you to conduct my
Ooh.
funeral. And she'd never done it before. And anyway, it's now turned into a 20-year-long career
Career.
for her. Now, she, one of the things that she said is that. One of the traps, if you're planning, and because she meets a lot of planners, is that if you're the person that is ill and you're wanting to do the planning, is to remember that sometimes having a memorial or a funeral isn't actually there for you. It's
Yeah.
there for the people that are being left
Yeah.
behind.
Good
So
point.
that's where you may need to loop in at
Yeah.
that time, your immediate family, those who are closest to you, and actually expand that circle out to get, bring them in on the whole sort of planning. And in some cases, I have now heard of some cases where those people have sort of said, well, let's do this the other way around. And I've heard of funerals where they've actually had
Yes.
the memorial, the wake, as it were, with the person before they've actually passed.
We just did that for my family member.
And
Because
that's
at the
another
time
option.
this person passes, none of us want a lot of people around. So I think a funeral, what a funny thing. We just called it a party to celebrate a birthday, but a funeral, how funny is that? I know people use words like celebration. I think you've got to think about what's the purpose. Like I recently went to a funeral that I know wasn't planned in advance, and it was very bland and didn't serve the purpose at all. It was really sad because it was going through the motions funeral, and you don't want that because a lot of money was spent and it was just nobody from the family stood up. It was awful. I ended up standing up because nobody else did. So it made me feel very sad. So one quick note about spiritual care. Now, I'm not really going to talk about spiritual care today, but have a talk to and think about your own and the person that's dying, who, how, and when. If you are church going, do you want a priest? Do you want last rites? If you have any other tradition, what do you want done? Have a think about it. Really important because, for example, for some reason, when I die, I want the ashes to ashes, dust to dust said. I want the committal, and I'm not a Christian. So what's that about? But it doesn't matter. Whatever you want that you feel is going to be important, do that.
So actually, and so, and while you're on that, that's a very good point. And this is another thing from my aunt, because we talk about dying all the time. Her and I, we're very close. And she was saying one of the trends that she has seen since the COVID pandemic era, where there were a lot of rules around how many could attend funerals and being mm-hmm. indoors and all that kind of stuff. She said a lot of people got rid of the traditional service. Yes. Funeral service, and just did a graveside committal service. Yeah. So very much like what you see on TV,
yeah.
and, you know, American
short.
Funerals. Yeah,
yes.
Very short, and you see the people all sitting
black
out.
The suits and the crying.
Yes, and the chairs and the open grave and the big OTT flowers and the picture and all graveside.
Yes.
And as she said, on the telly, that all looks very well and good.
Yeah.
She said, but there are several things that you must consider. She said, one is the weather.
Yes.
Because, you know, if it rains, you're out there. There is no, it's very difficult to get any form of shelter set up at these cemeteries, almost impossible in fact. So she said you have to be very mindful of the weather. If mm-hmm. it does rain, those who are elderly, what sort of contingencies will be made for them in terms of umbrellas and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The second thing she said you must consider is sound. She said too often they forget about the fact that if you've got, say, 150 people gathered around a gravesite and there's a little bit of wind or what have you, without amplification,
yeah.
it is almost impossible. She said even when you're shouting as a
yes.
celebrant, for everybody to actually hear what you're saying. So
yeah.
that does require having
mic and an amp.
Mic and an amp. And so she, for example, works with somebody who is a sound specialist who
right.
actually then created a special committal graveside setup.
Oh, cool.
To be able to do that. But she said that is something that you need to consider. So, for example, if you're somebody, if you've got teenagers and they've got one of those big boom boxes with a microphone attached, that's maybe all you require.
Or several UE booms
yes.
together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that you. So those are the sorts of little things she said that people mm-hmm. just won't even consider those
Good
sort of practicalities.
Point,
and because graveside committal services have become very, very popular now.
Popular.
And, she's, mm-hmm. and she said that is something that, and it, what then ends up happening is the morning of, everybody suddenly thinks
scrambles,
and they're scrambling around trying to find yeah. a solution.
And we do have very changeable weather. It could be too sunny and hot. You know, it mm. could be too, the sun's rays might be too sharp. That's, you know, that's New Zealand. Or it could be windy, like wind. Wind is almost worse than rain in a way. So, and if you've got a time set up, graveside, that's not going to change. That's just going to go ahead.
Yeah.
So actually something that the COVID era has helped with, I think, is freed people's minds a little bit. Because I know many people who had loved ones pass around that time, and we were very lucky with my parents, they died in between the lockups. So that was cool. But there are people I know that were relieved that they could only have 10 people. And so they had a very intimate graveside farewell. So that's a different thing. If you have an intimate a graveside farewell, the sound is not going to be an issue. But then, as you said before too, sometimes people do a private graveside or crematorium, and then they have a celebration either later that day or it might be months later. So there's so many ways of doing it. It's a matter of whether you want the person who's passed, you want their body in the room when you have your service, if you're going to have a service or celebration, or whether that doesn't matter to you. Does it, you know, maybe their cremated remains afterwards, or it might be none of their remains there. Mm-hmm. They may well have been buried. So have a think about what's important. The other thing is, for example, and this might be a bit obvious, but if somebody was part of a group like bowling club or marimba, or they went to Scottish country dancing or whatever they did, you could involve those people in doing something. For example, I like the idea, because I'm a yoga teacher and I love OMS. I'm not going to go into that, but I like the idea of having people doing, you know, consistent OMS as I'm buried. So, you know, that's another option. They might not want to do it. But you know, it can be really colourful. You can have people dancing to the graveside. There's nothing irreverent about that. Do whatever fits in with who you are or who that person is. And it's your moment or their moment. And from what I understand, I was speaking to a funeral director yesterday who said that time around the grave, if that's what you're doing, or even putting ashes into the ground, is very special, and that's the place where that person is, and there's no other place they're going to be, and that's a very special time, and you can do what you like.
Mm.
People will, you know, it could be playing, you could be playing loud rock music, whatever. People are going to be respectful of that moment because it really is only for a few minutes anyway.
So are there rules around where and how and who you can and cannot spread ashes?
Yes, you are not supposed to spread ashes in public places. Many, many people do. I know that we have. I know that when my grandparents died, they were sprinkled around trees in our local property. So you are not supposed to put ashes. And I'll tell you what ashes are in a minute too. They're not what you think. You're not supposed to put them in public places like rivers and that sort of thing. But a lot of people do put people into the sea. If it's going to be a place where there are people about that's known, like a national park, and it's going to be, you know, somewhere where there's going to be people about, you would ask permission. If in doubt, ask permission. But a lot of people put ashes in sneaky places off mountaintops, out of planes, out of boats. Sometimes people have ashes that go to all four corners of the country or the earth, or, you know, I know one of my loved ones' ashes recently went into a river that will go all the way out to the sea. So that's so yes, you're not supposed to spread ashes in a public place. Mm. That's the short answer to that question. So when the person actually dies, I wanted to talk about that, the actual physical body of the person and what the options are. If you have a funeral director, they will take your loved one away and deal with them in whichever way you have decided, whether they're being called, whether they are being prepared for viewing, whether there's going to be some repair work done because they've had a traumatic death, whether they're going to be embalmed, whether they're going to have their hair done, makeup, whatever you want to get done for your loved one in order to have a viewing, if that's what you want, or even if it's the person's going to be cremated and not viewed, like some of these are very cheap services, which there's nothing wrong with them, where the person's taken away, washed, clothed, put in a simple box and cremated. That's that deal I was talking about for the $2,500 to $3,000. But if the person's going to be viewed, there are many decisions and considerations to make about whether you would have them embalmed or not. For example, at a tangi, I know that they're usually 3 days long. I'm not sure what the traditional Māori point of view is. But I know that before embalming existed, we managed it ourselves. So for me personally, I don't want to be embalmed because I've done a deep dive into what embalming is. But it is appropriate for some people in some situations. But I wouldn't make the decision to do that willy-nilly just because you think it's the norm. It's actually, you know, both my parents weren't embalmed for their wishes. They were kept cool. And I viewed my father. I think he'd been dead for 10 days and he was fine. He was a bit bruised, but he was clothed. He looked good. He looked dead, which was what I wanted. I wanted to see him dead, to know that he was. So, you know, there's lots of decisions you make. Now, everything you get done costs. Embalming costs around $700. If you have your persons, that the simple cares that are done by a funeral director are to wash and dress, to close the lips and mouth, and obviously people think that holes are plugged. Now, that's not necessarily the case. Now this is where we're going to get into some detail that for some people might feel insensitive or a bit gory. So if you don't like these sorts of details, you might want to finish listening now.
Pop off and make a cup of tea and come back.
So let's start with your loved one dying at home. If you're going to have your person at home, you find them dead in bed in the morning and they are warm or they are cold, the first thing that you want to do, obviously, you know, that might be a bit of a shock, is to get them into a, if they're in bed, get them into a position that they might be in a coffin, because rigor mortis will set in at some stage. Well, I can tell you when. I've got a whole list of how long that takes. When my grandmother died, there's a funny story about how my mother and my sister tied her jaw shut, because quite often when people die, their mouths drop open, like that happened to my mum, and she was found with her mouth open. They tied my nana's mouth shut by putting a scarf around her jaw. you know, until she went to the funeral director, just to make it easy and to make them feel better about not looking at my nana with her mouth hanging open. And then they shut her eyes, and then they washed her face and hands and laid her out with her hands on her tummy so that she was in a position that was, you know, kind of neutral and coffin-like. Now, if you are going to look after your loved one at home, then you can wash and dress them as soon as you find them. And maybe, you know, there's no urgency. You can wait until the morning to ring the doctor to get the certificate of death if they've died naturally. You can wait until later in the day if you can't quite face making that phone call yet. And a lot of people do, you know, hair brushing, face washing. If they're in bed, it may be likely that they have, you know, their bowels and bladder have evacuated. It doesn't always happen. But I would, if they have, if you have one to hand or have them prepared, I would put an adult nappy on the person, because when somebody dies, it's different with every person, but if they have a full bladder and bowel, they will evacuate, and then there's other juices in the body as the person starts to decompose or let go. Because you imagine, you've got no muscle control of your sphincters anymore, so that happens. Some people have a mattress with a mattress protector when the person is in the process of dying, and they might put a Kylie across the bed. Now, I don't know why it's called a Kylie, but I always think of an Australian blonde when I think of a Kylie. But sorry if your name's Kylie. But that is basically like the old-fashioned strip that goes across the bed under someone's bottom, and it can contain quite a lot of fluid. So some of us have used something like that with our children. You can just use several sheets, but, you know, there can be quite a volume. So if that's what you want to do, you would probably strip your loved one and you would wash them. And sometimes that becomes something that a group of people do of carers. Wash their whole face, their armpits, their hands, everything, just with whatever you would normally use. It doesn't have to be some horrible, you know, I did some research on this. When you die, your bugs and germs that you might have in your body, they also eventually die. A dead person is not a hazmat situation unless they have had some horrible drug or some horrible disease that you've been warned about, and you're already wearing gloves, masks, and robes. If you're not already caring for them, wearing masks, gloves, and robes because they're toxic for some reason, and there's hardly ever an incidence of this, you know, that you've got to be nuclear reactive, then your loved one is not going to make you sick. If they're dead and you are looking after them, you are not going to be made ill by those. Quite the opposite. The living person has more bugs to share. It's the active breathing. It's the active live blood. When someone dies, their blood dies. Their bugs die. There's nothing to, you know, their main bugs die, the worms and all the other parasites we have inside us. They all die. And many of them will be evacuated when their bladder and bowel goes. So if you're looking after a loved one, yes, there might be poos and wheeze and stuff. Yes. But if you had kids, you've seen that all before, and if you've cared for the person, you have. So wash them and then put an adult nappy on them. And if they're going to the funeral director will take care of everything else. In fact, if they come early, they'll take care of that as well. So they really, really want to make it as dignified as possible. But if you're doing cares for your loved one, that's what you want to do. And then the thing you also need to do is keep your room cool, preferably lower than 10 degrees, because decomposition happens faster when someone is over 10 degrees. So ideally, you'd have your room down to sort of 5 degrees, like fridge temperature. If you can't get your room down to that, I would open, you know, doors and windows, put in fans. You can get portable air cons. You know, you can go buy them for $300 at the warehouse, get a portable air con if you have them, or you might already have them. And then what people do to cool the body, if they're going to do it all themselves, is use ice. So you go down and you grab two or three or four bags of ice from the BP or wherever you get your petrol and whatever, or have them already in the freezer if the person is going to pass. And you have double plastic bags. Now, if you have a double plastic bag, it will not stick to your loved one. But it's nice to have a cloth layer anyway. And people, the ice pack needs to be around the abdomen mainly, but I would tuck little ice packs around the shoulders and under the arms and all down the torso and in between the legs. And that will help cool the body. And the reason you want to cool the person's body is if you are not going to have them cremated or buried for a couple or two or three days, then you want to prepare the body in such the way that it's not going to smell. And you can take some advice. And of course, there are some funeral directors who will insist that the person needs to be taken care of and embalmed, et cetera, all cooled. What some people do is they have their loved one prepared and then they pay their funeral director to take the person away and to store them in a cool room. That's another option. But if you want that person in their house the whole time and not to go away, then you have to be prepared to deal with washing, dressing. I would put, you know, fresh sheets underneath with Kylie's and, you know, some plastic sheeting and stuff underneath.
If you essentially, if you want to go the natural way, there is a bit of work involved.
There is a bit of work involved. Mm. And you can get help. There are people that will help you for a small fee, as I said before, in your local area. And that might be what I choose to do when my loved one passes, or I might do it myself. I don't know until that happens, but I wanted my eyes wide open about the jobs that need to be done. And people do shave people. Their hair still grows for a short amount of time. So if you go to a funeral director, they will either glue or sew the lips together. They will often put plugs into the nostrils and into other orifices. And you can ask about what they are. They can be cotton or they can be plastic screws. I want to go the cotton route if that was the way. I do not want, because the plastic screws, if you have an imagination, will, you know, the flesh will be a little bit involved in that. But that's what a funeral director does. And then the thing that they're really, really good at, if you want to have the embalming process happen, if you want your loved one to look like they're still alive, that's what can be done. Now, personally, I don't like that because I like to see that the person looks dead because it helps me to accept it. But I do know that plenty of people choose to look like they are alive. Now, I've had a family member who even had their hair cut to a different style after they passed because that's what they wanted. They had a new style of haircut and they had full facial makeup. What the embalming process can do is to make the person look alive because they put colorant in the embalming fluid, if that's what you want. And they have all sorts of fluids to do all sorts of jobs. So if somebody died of cancer, they have fluid to help preserve the body a little more than the other fluids. If you want the person to look a bit more alive, they have fluid that has different pink tones or orange tones depending on your skin type and race, basically. The embalming process can be done in two stages, and again you'd have to talk to your funeral director about what they offer, because they do have differing offers around. But essentially this is what happens. There's two parts to it. Part one is the person lies naked on a metal tray, and what they do is open up I think it's artery at the side of the neck, so they make a little cut which they'll then cover up and sew up at the end, and they insert a tube into the artery. And the whole idea is that they are pushing the embalming fluid in and then the blood is coming out. So the blood runs out down the tray, down a hole and into basically the sewer. So it goes out with this, where your toilet waste goes. That's that person's blood gets drained. And that takes a little, that's a sort of a pumping process, or actually they use centrifugal force. And they're cleaning out all the person's blood and filling it with chemicals that are preservatives. So when that person is either cremated or buried, if the person's buried, they're going to last longer in the ground before they start to decompose. Yeah. If a person is placed in the ground without embalming, they will decompose a lot faster. So that's step one. Now that's done for cosmetic reasons. Step two is done to preserve the body longer. So let's say you're having a funeral in 10 days' time and you want the person to look good. They are going to have to do step two. Now, this is a bit gory again. So if you feel a bit sick in the stomach already, please don't listen to the rest of it. So there is a tool called a trocar, which is about a metre long. Now, trocars are used, and some of you will use it in other applications. It's basically a hollow tube with a pointy end and some holes in the pointy end. And that is inserted, I believe, I think it's 2 inches to one side and 2 inches below the tummy button, either above or below. It doesn't matter. It is inserted. The person stands at the foot end of your deceased person, and they put that trocar through into poke it into the abdomen. And they spend about 30 minutes moving the trocar around with suction and sucking out everything in there that's wet. Now, that includes the contents of your bowel and bladder. It actually includes most of your organs, your liver because they're wet, your lungs, and some of your heart. They can't see. They're just sucking out your organs, basically. And then into that hole goes embalming fluid. Because, of course, when you die, all the wet bits are in your abdominal area. I personally don't like that idea. I'm not going to have that done for me or my loved ones. But some people don't mind because they know that the body is no longer that person anymore. It's the shell of that person. And if you're doing it for purposes of the person being viewed so that they don't smell and they look good, then there's a good reason to do that. If people need to say goodbye and they're coming from overseas, you know, or from a long way away, or you're having a tangi and you don't, you know, it's in a warm room, etc., etc. Now, that's not magic. If you put that person in a warm room, they're not going to last forever. That's not how that works, but it's to give people time to say goodbye. But you need to know that that's what they're going to do. Okay, so that's something I didn't know until a few months ago. When I found out, I was a little bit shocked, to be honest.
Also, too, that's where those practicalities come in, isn't it?
Yep.
Where you're actually sort of doing your planning and you're thinking, yep, right, well,
what's going to happen?
Yeah, in an ideal situation, I'd love this, but actually, this, yep, may be more practical. And so you may actually have stepped instructions.
Yep.
If it's the middle of winter and, yep, you know, I'm happy with this. However, if this ensues, I will be prepared to consider,
absolutely,
this. Yeah. Because often too, as I mentioned before, the what happens after you pass isn't necessarily for you per se. It's for,
right,
those people left behind.
That's
so,
right,
it's making this pathway as easy for them as you possibly can.
That's
so,
right. I mean, my dad was held for viewing for me for 10 days in a cool room, and that would have cost some money. But I had to come from a long way away and had to organise a few things. And also we had other family members that had to travel. So, you know, you have to think about that. Now, so here's a little thing back to the physical care of the deceased person. How much time do you have? You do have time. If you find the person has passed, you know, you've got 2 or 3, well, you've got more time, but it's nice if you can do the washing and dressing within 2 or 3 hours. Here's some information, cool information. Rigor mortis is a protein reaction within your muscles that when you're alive, you have an actin and myosin and they help to contract your muscles. They don't work anymore. So there's all these terms. Algor mortis is immediate temperature drop 1.5 degrees an hour until it reaches room temperature. So that's if you have a lower room temperature, it goes down and down. Pallor mortis means the person turns pale. That happens within 15 to 20 minutes. Now, often, if you've been with someone that's passed, you see that. As with my dad, my sister was telling me that within 20 minutes he was pale. I wasn't there. Rigor mortis sets in from the face down, which is why people like to close eyes and shut mouths, because even though the person will become floppy again, if immediate family members are seeing that person, it's nice to have their mouth and their eyes closed, right? So do that. So that takes 2 to 3 hours to set in, and then peaks at 12 hours, right? So by 36 hours later, the person's soft again. So if you've got the person at home and you haven't washed them, after 12 hours, you can move them around, start to move them around again a little bit. So don't worry. Liver mortis is discoloration of the body, takes about 3 hours, and they'll be the same colour by about 12. And that's just the blood settling in the body if you're not having embalming. And then decomposition at 10 degrees will start to happen 24 to 72 hours later. So if you cool the body below 10 degrees, get it to 5 or below, that's going to slow right down. And in some cases, if the person had a simple death and they haven't got, you know, metastatic cancer, the body might last for several days. So that was that. Then the only other gory thing I want to talk about, well, gory for me, is cremation. So I didn't know a lot about cremation until I dug a little bit deeper, and it was different from what I thought. My own dad was cremated, and because he was large, it took 5 hours. The small, it makes sense, doesn't it? The smaller somebody is, the less time it takes to cremate, because essentially they are being burned in a very, very, very hot, controlled environment. Okay. So when someone is cremated, they must be cremated on a tray or in a box legally. So you can't just put them in like that. All the paperwork's done and they're going to be cremated. Normally, you cannot view the actual cremation process, but in some cases, you can ask to do that. You won't see the burning happening, but you'll see the person sliding in. Most crematoriums don't do that. They take the person away through the doors and then they do it. But you can ask. And usually, they have a little room where you can say goodbye and hang around for as long as you like and maybe write on the casket or whatever. So that might be where you have your little goodbye. Then the person is put into the cremator, and depending on the time of day, it gets hotter and hotter as the day goes on. They actually plan when they put people in, and the bigger people they like to put in earlier in the day, because it's to do with looking after the fire bricks inside the cremator. Then you go in, and at some point, and it might be more than once during the process of the burning, they will put their big long. It's like a broom with a metal bit on the end. It's not a broom, it's metal. They'll open the doors and they'll slide that in, and they'll actually move the bones around a bit to just sort of move things around so that it's more evenly cremated. At the end of the cremation, they let it cool for a short time. They will scrape with that same broom type thing all of the remains into a sort of a tray and let them cool. They remove it so that they can do the next person. So it is your body or your loved one's body there, but it's not every little millimeter of dust scraped out, but they do a pretty good job. And then they let them cool, and any large metal bits, like total hip replacements or parts of knee replacements or shoulder replacements, are then obviously taken out because they remain completely intact. I did ask a dentist about this. If you have a gold tooth, what happens? It's not valuable, so don't worry about it. It's only got some gold in it. It's got lots of other metal. It's only worth about $100, and it completely burns up in the process. I didn't mention that if you have pacemakers or anything like that, or a morphine pump, they will be surgically removed by the funeral director. So if you're doing your own home death prep, you may, and being cremated, you may need a GP or somebody else to come and do that for you. So it's something to remember if they've got a pacemaker. Pacemakers can blow up the crematorium.
Oh, yes, of course, with the
Yes.
batteries.
Yes.
Yes.
And also, if you've got a morphine pump, they're just sitting under the skin, they also have a battery. So they do ask questions about any implants. And sometimes people get scanned for them because the loved ones don't know. And then, so any metal big bits are then removed because they stay intact. And then they do pass a magnet over the remains to see if there's any other little bits of metal. Obviously, if you've got wedding rings and things, you should remove them just at the moment before the person's cremated. Then what happens is, you might not know this, but it's not ashes, it's bones. It's not at all, it's the bones. Every single bone in that person's body is intact. And they may have broken up, but you can see quite big pieces of bone, including pieces of skull and pelvis. So they then put it through. It's called a what's it called? Oh, not cremator. It's called a
Like a pulverizer.
yes, but it's got a word. It's they use the word crematory in it, and what it is a big drum. There's a few different models, but the most common one is a big drum with a whole lot of metal balls, and they pass it through and they have a sieve and it filters out the bottom. And if some crematoriums do it twice to make it more powdery. So that powder you see that's called ashes, they should call it bones. And I asked the funeral director why they don't call it bones, and they said because it's insensitive. So it's actually bone. So I think that's really important to know, because when you scatter the so-called ashes, some of it, like we did it into a body of water, some of it just sinks straight down and it sits there. So I think it's good to know these things, the reality of what actually
But the
happens.
other thing too that's I think comforting is the fact that it is bone. So then therefore it is actually your loved one.
Yes.
So that I think for a lot of people is quite comforting. So we've covered a lot of ground this morning. So we've covered sort of the practicalities of what to do at home, in terms of pre-planning. Well, people are still above ground and living and breathing in terms of what those legal obligations are, in terms of the elements of funerals and memorials and the different options there. And yeah, and this through awesome. The difference between embalming and cremating. Now, what anything else that people need to consider, Annie?
One thing I find interesting and a bit insensitive in a sense is that sometimes, very often, people leave the ashes or bones, remains, at the crematorium. I find that odd. A lot of funeral directors have boxes and boxes. People, I find that a bit interesting. And I also know of situations where people have left them behind for months, but then they make a very big fuss about scattering them. And I find that odd. I have the remains of one of my dogs on my shelf. I just can't seem to do something with it. And quite often people take those remains, share them. Oh, and there are many ways you can have remains of from the crematorium, at least, made into jewellery and all sorts of things. There's lots and lots of options. I won't go into those because probably you'll be, if you're using a funeral director, they will talk about that. But then some people have a service when they either bury the ashes, scatter the ashes, as we've discussed before. So there's lots of options.
No, there is a lot
just
of options.
Through all of them.
Look, this has been, I hope people have found this really informative. It's one of those conversations that often people will not have. It's not a terrifying conversation. And having been there and done that myself with a close family member, it is quite liberating and it does make a difference. So, hopefully, you know, and Annie, as Annie said, she's got a whole heap of resources that we're going to have with our wonderful Liz at the Inbox team. So that's inbox@realitycheck.radio or 2057 is the text. So if you're wanting some of those resources, especially if it's a text message, make sure you text saying resources from Annie's talk and provide Liz an email address so she can email those to you. And just do a little bit of research itself. And it is one of the, it's that old adage, isn't it? A little bit of preparation goes a long, long way. So do make sure you get yourself prepared. So thank you so much, Annie. This has been wonderful. And we've got another D up our sleeve that we might actually do a little later in the year as well. All right. This has been Annie Hart, Lifestyle Guru here on Reality Check Radio with Counterculture. Thanks, Annie, and we'll talk again soon.
Lovely to talk to you. Bye-bye.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.